As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred here with you in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time once more for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is folk, country, rock, singer, songwriter, and musician, Lucinda Williams. Grammy Award winner has a new album coming out Friday, April the 24th, titled Good Souls, Better Angels. And it features our recent coolest song in the world, You Can't Rule Me. That's her twist on a Memphis mini song. Let's hear some of that now, followed by my talk with Lucinda, on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Yeah, man, I got a right to talk about what I see. Way too much is going wrong right in front of me. You can't rule me. You can't rule me. You can't take my money and try to rule me too. Yeah, you might expect me to follow, but I ain't gonna fall in line. I tell you what, there's much I know. The dotted line ain't been signed. You can't rule me.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and joining me today for our coolest conversations is rock, folk, and country music singer, songwriter, musician, Lucinda Williams. Hi, Lucinda. How are you?
Hi. Well, I'm doing pretty good. You know, trying to hang in there.
Are you and your husband, Tom Overby, in the bunker?
Yes, we are. We've been hiding out in our house in Nashville for a good 3 weeks now.
How's the toilet paper holding out?
So far, so good, but we need to start looking for some more.
Oh, man.
and hand sanitizer, and I don't know. I'm trying not to go there, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, you know, on a more serious note, given everything that's going on, have any of your friends or loved ones become ill with this virus?
Yeah. A close friend of mine, Shyla Morrow, she's a mover and shaker about town and promotes a lot of shows in the Americana scene and everything. She came down with it, but she's pulled out of it, so she's good. And then, of course, Jackson Brown, you know, he came down with it, but his symptoms weren't too bad. And Larry Campbell, he got a pretty bad case of it, and then John Prine.
Right. I was watching.
So it starts to hit close to home, you know, when you start to know people.
Absolutely.
Like that, you know.
Well, the new album, Good Souls, Better Angels, that's due out Friday, April the 24th. And I'm guessing that you would have been out on the road now or shortly if the current crisis wasn't at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done any online performing, like anything through Facebook or posted any clips of you playing at home?
Yeah, we did. We actually did a thing for the Luck Reunion, the Willie Nelson Festival that was supposed to happen that we were getting ready to go down and do. It was supposed to happen, you know, during South by Southwest. So I got my guitar player, Stuart Mathis, who lives here in Nashville. He came over to the house and we sat in the living room and we videotaped and did some songs for that. because they had everybody who was supposed to be at the festival do that. And then, but we're getting ready to do a bunch more of that stuff.
Well, cool. So, and will that be happening around the time of the album's release?
Yeah, it's going to be happening, you know, like between now and then. You know, we're going to start taping some stuff. I think we're actually even going to go over to the studio, to Ray Kennedy Studio, where we recorded the album, so we can get really good sound and do it over there.
Oh, cool. I mentioned that Good Souls, Better Angels is due out in 2 weeks, and it features this week's coolest song in the world, You Can't Rule Me, and that's also the title to a Memphis Mini song. So I went back to look at your first album, Ramblin', to see if you covered any Memphis Mini on there, and I don't think you did. Mm-hmm. So are you channeling her on this track?
Yeah. Well, actually, I did record, there was a version of Me and My Chauffeur Blues.
Oh, okay.
On there. I think, unless I'm thinking wrong. It's been so long ago, and I don't have the album in front of me. But I've been into her for years and years and years, you know.
Well, tell me about your love for Memphis Minnie. How'd you come across her?
Well, I might have discovered her, now that I think about it, through an album with Jeff Muldar and Maria Muldar. They had a couple albums that they did together. One was called Pottery Pie. Uh-huh. And they covered some Memphis Mini stuff, and I heard them do it. And anyway, I was real drawn, you know, for different reasons. She's great, a great artist, but, you know, one of the few female blues artists who played guitar, wrote songs. So, you know, that made her stand out. She hung out with the guys, and she could drink with the best of them, and, you know, she would spit in your face. I mean, you know, she was a ball buster, this woman. So, you know.
And so that particular tune, how did you settle on that? You Can't Rule Me.
I just loved it. It really spoke to me because it's such a powerful song. And so she's busting this guy's balls in this song, you know, in her version of it. Then I took it and made it more, you know, speaking to the people in the government, you know, who trying to rule us, you know. So I kind of put a different spin on it. But you can interpret it however you want. That's the great thing about it, you know.
Well, you mentioned Ray Kennedy, and my notes say the new album was produced by you and Tom and him. And you had worked with Ray years ago on Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. What got you interested in working again for this album?
Well, it's funny. We actually didn't plan it. It wasn't really officially planned, but, you know, we'd run into Ray from time to time, and he kept saying, you know, y'all need to come over and come to my studio and check it out and just, you know, maybe cut a couple of things and see how it goes. So it was kind of that sort of thing. And so we were in between tours, and, you know, we took the band in. We kept them over a few days because Butch and David, my drummer and bass player, still live in L.A., so... Oh. They stayed over a few days, and we went in just with the intention of, you know, sort of testing the waters, and we were just blown away. You know, it was like, oh, my God, this sounds amazing. And the other thing is Ray's got all these, he has this huge collection of vintage guitars and vintage amplifiers. So I was playing through, you know, like on some of the tracks, I was playing through a 1950s guitar going through this 1950s amplifier. So that gives it that sound, you know, a certain sound. And so it was the combination of the songs and the sound we were getting in the studio and what Ray was doing. And so then we just kept going, and we were on a roll, so we just kept going. And we cut a bunch of other tracks, too, that are going to be on the next album. But, yeah, well, that's how I do it now, is we just go in and just cut a bunch of stuff and then decide what works, which songs work best together, you know.
Well, how did you come across Ray to begin with?
Well, that was when Steve Earle was recording his album called El Corazon.
Okay.
And he asked me to come in and sing on that song, You're Still Standing There. Mm-hmm. And he was working with Ray. They were working together, Steve's albums, and they produce other albums. And they called themselves Twing Trust. And so that's how I met Ray. It was his studio that he had at that time. And I just loved the sound he was getting so much in there. And so I was in the middle of doing the Car Wheels album, and I wasn't happy with some of the tracks. And so, you know, that's what led me to go in and recut some stuff with Ray. And, you know, but it was mostly because what Ray was doing, how he was engineering things and the sound he was getting in there. And that was more what I wanted on the Car Wheels album. And, you know, so that's what led me to go in and end up recutting the whole album with Ray. Wow. That's a whole other story.
Right. So Ray is the man with the sound back then and even today. He still got it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Definitely.
I wanted to ask you about recording the new album. You did it there at Ray's place, and this was over the course of how long?
Well, actually, altogether, because, you know, we were still on the road back and forth.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, we'd spend a few days, and then we'd have to leave and then come back and record some more. But I think altogether it was like about 2 weeks, you know, of tracking.
Oh, okay.
The other thing is that we didn't take as long because we didn't have, you know, a lot of overdubs with, you know, other people coming in and doing harmonies or any, you know, all that stuff, which I was thinking we were going to do, but then we decided, you know, it just had this cool sound just by itself without all that. So, yeah, we just left it alone.
So back in 2017, my band, The Woggles, we opened for you and Jesse Mallon at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey, and you had a killer band behind the band. So, are these the same guys in the band or on the new album then?
They would be the same guys then, yeah. Butch Norton on drums and David Sutton on bass. Now Stuart was with us. Stuart, it would have been the same band then. Stuart, you know, he was Stuart Mathis was in the Wallflowers before.
Oh, well, I didn't realize
he played with them for a long time.
He at that show, he and I spoke briefly, and I just thought, you know, I really enjoyed his playing with you, and just seemed like a really great guy too.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, they all are. I mean, I'm really lucky, you know, because we just have, and the crew too, you know, it's like a family.
Well, you mentioned when we were talking about the coolest song of the week here, You Can't Rule Me, how, you know, it's open for interpretation. And they're like an overriding theme for the album. Certainly it's open for interpretation, but do you have a specific theme in mind that you know, that served as your inspiration for it or not?
Yes. The, you know, all the crap, all the bullshit and the crap going on, you know, with the feeling, you know, when I was writing a lot of these songs, I'm feeling just like a lot of people, you know, frustrated and angry. And, you know, so that was what was behind that was the feeling, you know, when I was working on a lot of these songs.
And for yourself, personally, yeah. Is it cathartic for you?
Yes. Yes, it always is when I write. That's the thing is my songs, I'm an artist first and foremost, you know, I'm not an entertainer necessarily, you know, so I'm writing, it's my self-expression coming from me. And then, you know, the craft comes in, I try to make it so that other people can, you know, respond to it and relate to it and all of that, you know, but first it comes from me. I have to do what I do, you know, I have to write.
So, your dad was a literature professor, very highly regarded poet. Have you ever considered writing fiction, or, you know, you tell your stories through song, and that's the way you see yourself?
Yeah, that was my, you know, yeah, that was my form of self-expression. I thought about trying to write poetry. When my dad was still living, you know, I remember giving him something that I thought might turn into a poem, you know, and he said, I remember exactly what he said. He said, honey, I think this wants to be a song, you know, so I think there was this kind of thing where my dad was the poet and I was the songwriter, and, you know, so I never really ventured into that world, you know, that much. So I don't know. I know how to write a good song. I don't know the rules of poetry. I mean, you know, if I were to start writing poetry, it would just, I don't know if it would be accepted or anything. I don't know. You know, it's a whole different animal, really.
Well, you've been pretty, well, very successful as a songwriter. I'm sure that, if that was something you felt a calling for, you could certainly write some great poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, talking about the catharsis of the album and, you know, the events that have been going on that, you know, you channeled for that, And speaking of your dad, and so you lost him back about 2015, is that right? To Alzheimer's?
My mother, I lost my mother in 2004, and then my dad about 10 years later. Or so he actually died on January 1st, the same day that Hank Williams died, because he loved Hank Williams.
Oh, well, what I've understood is that he passed away from Alzheimer's, and given that he was a man of letters, that really must have been horrific for you to deal with.
Oh, yeah. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. I remember the day I was visiting, and we started talking about poetry, and he said, you know, just was this real calmly and said, honey, I can't write poetry anymore. And I just lost it, and I started crying, and, you know, I just sobbed like a baby, because it was like a part of him had died. So that's the horrible thing about that disease, is you watch the person just disappear, you know, the person you knew.
Right. And the song, If My Love Could Kill, that was a way that you were trying to deal with that, right?
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, so Good Souls, Better Angels, that's like your 15th or so studio album. If I'm counting things right, about 15. Does that sound right?
Probably. I don't know. I don't care.
So you've got this great body of work, but another thing I really love about your discography, and you alluded to this earlier when you talked about coming in and singing on a Steve Earle track, is that you're contributing to other people's albums, and you got these appearances and duets from the likes of John Prine and Jimmy Dale Gilmore to Little Milton and Ray Davies. And there are a couple of these folks I'd like to ask you about. And the first is Evie Sands. You and she sing on the album Women in Prison. The song is Cool Blue Story. And I've always felt like that woman just got short shrift, like she's a singer and a talent that remains unheralded. How did you find out about her?
Because we had a mutual friend, and I think that's how we connected, was that way, you know. But I knew her name. I wasn't real familiar with her background or anything. Mm-hmm. And then I went and checked it out, and I felt the same way you did. Like, what happened? You know, she is a really valuable talent. I guess she had one hit song back in the 60s or something.
Well, so there's like everything she did in the 60s, it was like co-opted, like Take Me for a Little While. There's a guy that took like the test pricing of the record and used it as a demo and shopped it to Chess Records. And so this Chess Records artist released it at the same time. So her version never broke. Mm-hmm. And then the Hollies did I can't hold back or I can't hold it, just around the same time that she did. Well, she also was the first to record Angel in the Morning.
Yeah,
but her version, you know, wasn't
that's right. That's what I read. I remember reading about that. Yeah, she just has the bad luck, you know.
And so have you ever kept in contact with her since then?
A little bit, you know. I have her email address and everything, and, you know, I'd run into her at different clubs around LA sometimes when I was still living out there, but I haven't seen her in a while, so I don't know what she's up to these days.
In 2004, you teamed up with Tony Joe White for the tune Closing In on the Fire, the album's The Heroines. What a great duet. I mean, I feel like it's you two putting Lee Hazlewood and Nancy Sinatra to shame on that one. How did you hook up with Tony Joe?
Oh, God. Well, I've been a huge fan of his, you know, for forever, you know, since he first put out Coke Salad Annie, probably. And I got to meet him. It's when I was living here. I lived in Nashville before in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And he was playing a little place, and I went to see him play. And I think he started hearing about me, you know, and everything. And I was able to meet him that night. And so we just stayed in touch over the years. And well, the other thing is that his son was, you know, you mentioned that Little Milton album that I sang on.
Yeah,
which was recorded at Muscle Shoals. Well, Tony Joe's son was managing him managing Tony Joe, and he was organizing that album. I think that's how I ended up on that Little Milton album. I'm not sure, but anyway, so the connection was made with Tony Joe, and, you know, so we just, you know, did a few things together, and then of course I got him on in the studio to play on a couple of tracks, you know, before this album. He was a God, what a treasure.
And lastly, I'm a big Five Royales fan, and in 2011, you teamed up for a couple of songs with Steve Cropper on his Five Royales tribute album, Dedicated, including Dedicated to the One I Love. And honestly, I mean, I'm more like a Monkey Hips and Rice man, but that is a really great tune. When did you first hear Dedicated to the One I Love?
Probably when it was on the radio. You know, I've been working on this project lately because I got asked to do Pitchfork is doing this thing where they're asking different artists to, in 5-year increments, to list their whatever songs or albums, you know, affected them in that particular year. Uh-huh. So my list starts at, I think, 1958. Uh-huh. And then it goes, and I would have only been 5 years old, so I don't know what I was listening to in 1958. And then it goes in 5-year increments. And it just made me, you know, when you do something like that, it's just, it reminds you of the level of quality of the songs that were on the radio back then in the 60s and, you know, that whole period. They have it going in 5-year increments up to now. You know, and as soon as I got past a certain year, it was like, because what I would do is I would just to try to remember everything. You know, I would Google, you know, Wikipedia, like whatever top 100 Billboard songs, you know, for that year.
Right.
And it was just like, it was kind of mind-blowing because it was the difference between 1968, what was on the radio, versus 1988.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, God, what happened? You know, what the hell? But I remember hearing, you know, I'm old enough to have heard all those great songs, you know, back then.
Well, Steve Craw, how did that come together?
Through this guy, Fred Mollin, mm-hmm. M-O-L-L-I-N, and he was producing it. And I met him when I was living in Nashville before in the 90s, and he's asked me to come in and sing on a few different projects, and that was one of them. He also did a Jimmy Webb album that I went in and sang on. So that's how I connected with that project, was through Fred Mollin. Yeah. Now,
the other tune I want us to hear off the new album is Man Without a Soul. And when I hear the song and I think about the album title, Good Souls, Better Angels, it makes me think of this John Meacham book called, a recent book called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Have you heard of this book?
Yeah. Well, Tom read it. Tom's a smart one. You know, he's a voracious reader. And actually, that is where that site, that the idea for that came from. I'm impressed that you knew about that.
Well, well, thanks, Lucinda. But yeah, so what I like about the book is, you know, Meacham's a well-known historian, and he's trying to put things in the darkest times kind of in perspective that, you know, there have been these trials and tribulations always through our history, and the country's been divided many different times. And, you know, we managed to survive, although when I got around to reading the book, I mean, I knew what he's going for, but it was making me angry because of the stuff that was happening at the time. I was like, yeah, you can tell me things are going to get better, but I think things just keep getting crazier. So again, this is speaking to, you know, thanking you for the album. With Man Without a Soul, you've played that song live, haven't you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And before you play the song, do you say, you know, this is about, did you just play it?
No, I just say this is a song that's going to be on the new album. You know, Tom said something about this the other day. He said, don't tell people it's about Trump. And I said, I'm not telling anybody it's about Trump. They're telling me it's about Trump, you know. And then Tom goes, he has a great sense of humor too. He says, well, you know, it could be about Mitch McConnell, you know, so it doesn't have to be about Trump, but it's about that, the figure, you know. It made me think, because this was Tom's idea, that line, you know, the idea for that song. We've been working a little bit together on stuff, you know, and he would just come up with these ideas and these lines, and he brought me that one, and I said, honey, everybody's got a soul. Nobody doesn't have a soul, you know, and Tom kind of looked at me and said, well, you know, maybe there might be an exception to that. But then he also said, you know, just look at it like an expression. You know, man, this guy ain't got no soul, you know, that kind of thing. But it also made me think of that line in the Neil Young song where he says, even Richard Nixon has got soul, you know, kind of the opposite thing. But anyway, so I kind of resisted it a little bit, and then Tom kept pushing for it. He goes, no, I think this is a great, this is really a good idea, and, you know, and so then I took it and I came up with what we have, and people have just been reacting really positively to it. I mean, you know, I don't know how these songs are going to go over with everybody. I mean, obviously, this is the most outspoken I've been about things on this album.
Right.
You know, I'm kind of just at that point in my life that, like, tired of trying to please everybody, you know?
Yeah.
So it just needed to be done, you know? And if somebody can't handle it, then I can't help that. You know, this is, I'm an art. Like I said, this is my art. This is my piece of art to you, to everybody. So it feels good to have it done, you know?
Well, number one, I'm glad Tom pressed you on it because I think it's a great song. And I want to ask you, there's a line in there you sing, how do you think the story ends? It's not a matter of how, it's just a matter of when. So what happens if it doesn't end at the end of this year? What happens?
Oh, God, I can't even think about that. At the end of the day, I'm an optimist, so I have to think that way. I have to have hope. You know, we have to have hope. So here's the deal. If enough people, like, now we're talking politics, but if enough people just get to the damn polls, just go there, you know, and vote blue, that's our only chance.
Well, like yourself, I'm going to consider myself an optimist, and to you now I raise my half full glass and say cheers. I want to thank you, Lucinda, so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
This has been great. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, give my best to Tom, and we're going to give a listen now to Man Without a Soul off Good Souls, Better Angels. It's Lucinda Williams here in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
You're a man without truth, a man of greed, a man of hate, a man of envy and doubt. You're a man without a soul. All the money in the world,
Without a Soul. That's Lucinda Williams here in Little Stevens Underground Garage, and that track is off her upcoming album, Good Souls, Better Angels, due out Friday, April the 24th. This is the Mighty Manfred, and big thanks again to Lucinda for speaking with me today, and thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. Join me next week when I'll chat with Jen Razavi, one of the guitar players in the LA-based pop-punk band The Bomb Pops. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it decide, baby, diamond ring.